Hi, this is Christy Robillard for the Virtue Podcast, and I'll be teaching from Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 15 through all of chapter 3. I'll be covering the last two of the five woes and Habakkuk's praise response, his song. I once served jury duty on a high-profile murder trial. It lasted all summer, and it became apparent very early on that we were not the first jury to listen to the case, so knowing this, it placed an extra burden on us jurors to get it right the second time around. And so as the witnesses were sharing their testimony, I quickly began to realize why the first jury struggled. You see, the case hinged on the testimonies of one very dubious and somewhat confused woman and one confidential informant who was in prison for particularly evil and heinous crime. It was hard to look at him, let alone listen to his testimony. And I think because of this, his critical testimony was not believed by the first jury. But I listened, and I actually believed his testimony because I knew he would be telling the truth if he could describe a subtle and unusual fact about the crime scene that he could only know if the defendant had personally confided in him. Well, unfortunately, after almost 3 months of jury service and a week of deliberations, our jury was hung also. I was so disappointed in some of my fellow jurors and personally discouraged because I had prayed for a revealing of truth and justice throughout the trial. I had prayed that we would be the jury that got it right either way. Well, God answered those prayers, just not at that time. It was 3 years later, on the front page of the local section of the paper, the defendant's photo prominently displayed that I read there was a third jury, and they did get it right. I so rejoice for the victim's family, particularly her son, who was a police officer, and I celebrated God's faithfulness and his faithful justice. And I also remembered the morning after our release from jury service that in my agonizing prayer to the Lord, feeling so defeated, I asked why. He then ministered truth to my heart. No one gets away with murder. Lady Justice may be subverted, but not God. And he had a plan. You know, it doesn't always go this way when in a relatively short amount of time we see God move, does it? But even though we may not witness justice in our lifetime, God is faithful, even if we are faithless, for he cannot deny himself. That's 2 Timothy 2:13. And this is the whole point of God's prophecy in the book of Habakkuk. And so I've titled this podcast, Even Though God is Faithful. So let's take a look at the fourth woe from chapter 2, verse 15. Woe to you who make your neighbors drink, who mix in your venom even to make them drunk so as to look on their nakedness. Verse 16, you will be filled with disgrace rather than honor. Now you yourself drink and expose your own nakedness. The cup in the Lord's right hand will come around to you, and utter disgrace will come upon your glory. The fourth woe deals with immorality, which is just one more type of exploitation by Babylon. The first mention of drunkenness is found in Genesis 9, where Noah's son Ham found Noah drunk and exploited his own father by exposing his nakedness to take advantage and embarrass him. When someone becomes intoxicated, they more easily can become a victim of any number of crimes, as well as their own. Clearly, the message in these verses of Habakkuk are directed to Babylon, but all should take note to not place themselves in the position to be victimized in the first place. Interestingly, Babylon, the intoxicator, fell to the Persians, and the practice of Babylon became law in Persia, as recorded in Esther 1:8. The Persians then fell to the Greeks under Alexander the Great. The Greeks then fell to the Romans, and where are the Romans today? All of the former world dominating powers fell, but Israel still stands. Babylon's success was only temporary. I remember watching the news when Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed the UN in 2013 regarding the prevention of Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons. He said, "If Israel is forced to stand alone, Israel will stand alone." And Israel has and will stand. She is the Lord's anointed. And in bringing this home to our current culture, I think about our nation and the stats which indicate we are at an all-time high for consuming intoxicants of all types. There is big money being made at the expense of precious lives and families and even our society. There is thought that there is a power strategy by other nations to weaken our nation through exploiting addictions, and this is probably true. It's repulsive to God. God sees every bit of it. But remember, our real enemy is Satan, and his strategy is to steal, kill, and destroy, John 10:10. We might be quick to point the finger at other nations exploiting American weaknesses, just like Babylon did to Judah. But what do Americans do? I think about the most vulnerable in our society, children and unborn. They are being exploited, taken advantage of, mutilated, and murdered right under our own noses. And God sees. We take comfort in knowing God sees justice and that there will be a day, but we need to keep our own short accounts, remembering our own accountability to a just God. And that promised judgment in verse 16, it is the cup of the Lord. Describing judgment as a cup may sound almost benign because we might think to ourselves, you know, what can a cup hold? After all, it's just a cup. This cup, the cup of the Lord, in his right hand is the wrath of God. This should strike terror in every soul that it is pronounced to, nation or individual. I fear for those who will take that cup from God. I really do. And I have even prayed prayers telling the Lord, I fear for that person or persons or group. Lord, call them out of darkness. Lord, be merciful. And I also find myself pretty undone as I consider our completely innocent, perfect, and sinless Jesus who did take that cup, the cup of wrath. And not just a sip, but he drank every bit, every last drop. And he knew exactly what was in that cup. This is why in the Garden of Gethsemane, he agonized to the point of sweating blood while in prayer. Luke 22:44. But Jesus, because he drank the cup of God's wrath, we drink the cup of salvation, Psalm 116:13. Because Jesus drank the cup of God's wrath, we drink the cup of blessing, 1 Corinthians 10:16. Because Jesus drank the cup of God's wrath, we drink the cup of communion and fellowship with him, 1 Corinthians 11:25. Salvation, blessing, and communion. No wonder David writes in Psalm 23, my cup overflows. Jesus took the wrath of God, his Father, so that you and I, as born-again Christians, will never know his wrath. We only know God's discipline. So when you experience the Lord's discipline as described in Hebrews 12:6, remember, it's just discipline, not judgment. Don't take God's discipline for granted. Be ever so thankful for it because it came at the highest cost. Don't waste it. Learn and be trained by it. And now for the fifth and final woe from verse 19. I see a possible reason it is listed last as the fifth woe. I noted there is a digression from the prior four woes. The fifth woe deals with idolatry, which is always at the root of rebellion and sin. The Babylonians rejected Jehovah, the self-existent God, and when they rejected him, they put themselves in his place. This is what idolatry really is. The Babylonians were gods to themselves. They trusted in their own handiwork, and their own strength was their God, as described in chapter 1. Whether they made an image to be a focal of worship, or they worship the things of their own desires less, and even successes. And so the contrast can't be more vivid in verse 20. But the Lord, Jehovah, the self-existent God, as this is his name in this verse, is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him. The self-existent God does not need man to exist, but idols do. The proclamation from God and identifying himself in this way and then adding, so let all the earth be silent, is the period on God's second reply to Habakkuk. To be silent before the Lord isn't just to be quiet. This word in Hebrew is hold your peace. There is no rebuttal to be made, even inside of oneself, not just spoken words. This is a holy hush. Positionally, God is in his temple, not a man-made temple, but a God-made temple. And this position reminds us of his sovereign, holy rule over all the world. And just for a personal application point, we see idolatry primarily today in the form of misplaced hope and trust in people, policies, and politics. This is misplaced hope and trust because all of these are fallible, no matter how good. There is only one who is infallible, the self-existent God, Jehovah. So be careful where you place your hope and trust. The Lord is now done answering Habakkuk. The period is placed. And in my mind's eye, I see Habakkuk on his knees, or maybe even on his face as he considers all that he has heard from the Lord. And his natural response is to worship, even to sing, and he is more emboldened to ask for more. Isn't this your experience too, once the Lord has answered your prayer? Doesn't it make you want to pray more? It does me. And so Habakkuk had one more request: remember mercy. Chapter 3, verse 1, Habakkuk prays, Lord, I have heard the report about you, and I fear. O Lord, revive your work in the midst of the years. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. Habakkuk begins his prayer to God, addressing him as God has just described himself, Lord, in all caps, Jehovah, the self-existent God. Habakkuk will later go into detail about all that he has heard about God, but before he does, he asks God to continue the work he is famous for. Make it known is another way of saying reveal your work. You are the one who has done great and mighty things. Nobody else. No flukes of happenstance. So do it again, Lord. And we can all say amen to this, can't we? Habakkuk accepts judgment must come, but he pleads with God to remember mercy. Habakkuk's contemporary Jeremiah wrote similar words in his lament in Lamentations 3, 22 through 23. The Lord's loving kindnesses indeed never cease, for his mercies never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. Mercy is an attribute of God, and likewise, whenever we practice mercy towards one another, we are exercising traits of our Heavenly Father. And when I remember this, it makes me want to look for more opportunities to be like Him in practicing mercy. While many of us are frustrated, angered, even possessing righteous anger, and lament over the condition of our culture, we may want judgment to come down, but we need to remember mercy too, just like Habakkuk. Verses 3 and 4 describe the glory of God. His glory is separate from his self-existent title. His glory is his person. As I read verse 4, I immediately think of Revelation 1:16, which also describes the glory of the resurrected and glorified Jesus. His face was like the sun shining in its strength. Verses 5 through 15 describe the power of the saving acts of God. Look at verse 6. God just stood. You know, he didn't need to fly about from sea to shining sea. He just stood, seeing the whole earth, seeing into every crack and crevice of men's hearts. Warren Wiersbe writes, in fact, God calmly measured the earth as a sign that he possessed it. To measure something is an indication that it's yours and you can do with it what you please. It's also a preliminary step to action, as though the Lord were surveying the situation and estimating how much power it would take to execute his wrath on the nations. As always, I feel like this is good insight by Mr. Wiersbe. Now I want to draw your attention to verse 13 because of its topic, and also there is a Selah rest, or pause to think. Verse 13, You went forth for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. You struck the head of the house of the evil to lay him open from thigh to neck. Selah. When I pause to think about this, I cringe because this is explicit. So this can be historically speaking of God's prior deliverances, or this can also be prophetic about what will happen to the Babylonians. This can also be prophetic of Jesus having already struck Satan and our promised salvation. Commentators agree to disagree. I personally think this verse can apply to all three. The word salvation in this verse in the Hebrew is yesha, where the name Jesus is derived. Looking back historically or looking forward prophetically, Satan is a defeated foe and the Lord is our salvation. Now let's look at verses 16 through 19. The free-thinking prophet who's not afraid to wrestle with the Lord over issues he doesn't understand, after two rounds with the Lord, finally relents because of his increased understanding of the person, power, and plan of God. The more Habakkuk knows about the planner, the more he trusts his plans. So Habakkuk prays, "I trembled inside when I heard this. My lips quivered with fear. My legs gave way beneath me, and I shook in terror. I will wait quietly for the coming day when disaster will strike the people who invade us. Even though the fig trees have no blossoms and there are no grapes on the vines, even though the olive crop fails and the fields lie empty and barren, even though the flocks die in the fields and the cattle barns are empty, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will be joyful in the God of my salvation. The sovereign Lord is my strength. He makes me as sure-footed as a deer, able to tread upon the heights." We are back to waiting. Habakkuk's first question in chapter 1, he asks, "How long must I wait?" Now Habakkuk's last confession is, "I will wait." Time spent in conversation with the Lord is never wasted. There's no more complaining, fretting, or anger. Habakkuk will wait patiently. Habakkuk is compliant and fully accepts what must be, although it terrifies him and has shaken him to the core. Waiting isn't something most of us like, because if we're honest, most of us want to be in control and take matters into our own hands, right? But waiting on God is recognition that He is in control and brings us to the end of our journey much faster than we can bring ourselves. Our journey is all about faith, and the righteous shall live by his faith. We all will have experiences when we will be shaken to the core, when our faith is truly tested, when we're confronted with, "Do I really believe God is who He said He is? Do I really believe His plans are good, that He is good? Do I really trust Him?" How we respond on the day of shaking is how we have already responded to revealed truth by the Holy Spirit. The days of shaking are only the days of revealing what God already knows about us. Have you been shaken? What was your response? Were you angry at God? Were you disappointed with God? Did you lose faith? Or did you say, "Even though I trust you, I believe in your goodness and that you are working things out for my good, even though I don't understand"? When God said, "I am raising up the Babylonians," it was God saying, "I am sending pain." At the very foundation of all of God's dealings with us, no matter how painful, confusing, and dark, we must dare to believe in His goodness, mercy, justice, and love. And yes, love allows pain. Look at the cross. Remember, God doesn't necessarily send what we want. God sends what we need. Today, in our nation, in our culture, in our homes, and in our hearts, only God knows exactly what He has allowed or even raised up to be His instrument to bring us in, to bring us back, in order to bring us up. Work with him. Don't fight a losing battle. Be transformed as you consider who God really is, just like Habakkuk did. Watch and wait. Today, be honest to God and tell him, even though, make this your prayer, even though you don't understand and may not agree, you may not feel like you have the faith to pray this way, but do it anyway. Do it anyway. There is a blessing waiting for you, for God is a rewarder of faith, Hebrews 11:6. So thank you so much for listening, and I pray the Lord to strengthen your faith and to bless you as you surrender in faith to a faithful God who loves you. And remember, even though, God is faithful.